go. Oh, excellent. I don't have to shout. Thank you. So, who was in the presentation yesterday? Excellent. Thanks for returning. And so my name's Neil Cross. I look after financial services in Asia. It's a pretty big territory. New Zealand's obviously the best part. And then we go up Australia into Southeast Asia. I'm based in Singapore, up to Japan, China, Hong Kong, and over to India, and everywhere else in between. So I've been at Microsoft about 7 years. Before this, I started life as a games developer. Wrote quite a few games for the ZX Spectrum. If those that remember it, they had the 16K version. I was lucky, I got the 48K. But you couldn't use all of it anyway because some of it was used for screen. Had this great rubber keyboard, and good to see that the Microsoft Surface has a rubber keyboard as well, so we're going back to that. But these chips now, the Z80s, they're used for things like washing machines and greeting cards. We are in a place where we have millions of times the memory storage and compute power. And so all through my life, I've been really interested in things like machine learning. Gamification's a kind of new term, but I think it's an old one. And really looking at the experience that people have with software. For too long, software has really been something we design and we dictate the negotiation interface with the customer. Thankfully, we're going for a phase where we really think about the customer first and what they're trying to achieve, or the user using that software, and then we try and hide the complexity of the mechanics of how our systems work from how the customer wants to interact with it. I covered a lot of that yesterday. What I'm going to cover today is world-class. I'm going to do two things, actually. I completely rebuilt my deck at 6 o'clock this morning. I got a lot of questions about the process of innovation. How do we become innovators? How do we be successful at being innovators inside our corporate networks? So I split the presentation in two. First up, we're going to have a look at some world-class, very real, very now customer interactions. And that's across retail, that's across online and banks as well, obviously, with my background. And then after that, we're going to talk through process of innovation. We're going to look at some software Microsoft has which can help you manage the innovation process, and talk a bit about crowdsourcing and how crowdsourcing has fundamentally changed the way we ideate, select and evolve and deliver world-class innovation. So first up, I've got a few great examples of people, customers and partners using our technology around stores and branches. I'll start off with the first video on this. This is from the Bank of Moscow. They have used our Connect technology to give their customers a 24-hour ability to interact with their marketing and their product on a digital asset. Pretty interesting, hey? So it's a great way to create excitement, a great way for even when your store or branch is closed, for people to still engage in your media. And in Moscow, there's obviously a distinct shortage of audio devices, so everyone makes their own sounds. So I thought it was quite funny, the guy making the sound effects. And we're seeing lots of this. So there's banks in Europe that have this inside shopping malls, so you can interact with the devices. I've saw Kiwi Bank in their offices have a Kinect experience where you can kind of fly over the landscape and again experience their digital media directly off a Kinect. They've actually got it on three projectors, so it's a huge, huge wall there. Secondly, we did a lot of work a number of years ago with BNP Paribas, and they created their new flagship branch. And a flagship branch is a great way to spend like $5 to $10 million. You create this, you know, amazing experience, and it's a way really to trial new branch design and new technology assets, and you know, work out the strategy for how you deliver that down to your other branches. And you can liken flagship branches to the Paris fashion show. You see clothes on stage worn by people, and those clothes, you know, no one will ever wear them. But 6 months later, you get a watered-down version of that clothing line worn by normal people. So in a flagship branch of the Paris fashion show, then they dilute that down and then distribute that out across their branch channel. And we did a lot of work with them around the Microsoft phone, Pixel Sense, and OCS technology, now called Link. So not all of that is deployed. There's some of that, obviously, you may have spotted the movement of process across devices. We can only really start doing now with the advent of ubiquitous NFC, and Windows 8 Mobile will have it for Christmas. But everything else in there that you saw was part of the process. And the best innovations I've, well, there's lots of innovations I've seen, but some of the best I've seen is where you move up the value chain. So the person was involved in buying a car, but the BNP managed that all the way through from them getting a recommendation from that car, looking at the car probably from their grandmother, and then was able to book an appointment with an advisor, go into a branch, start looking at a financial scenario for a loan, and then getting that sent to them directly and keeping them engaged all the way through. Maybe a banking scenario, but there's plenty of other scenarios in other industries where we really try and capture the attention of the customer at the very first instant that they're thinking about either purchasing a product or being part of an engagement process. Now, this final one is really fun. This is really what I'm seeing as the first stage of interaction based on store frontage. And we'll show it first, and I'll talk about what we're doing that makes this even more enticing for the customers and the retailers moving forward. Amazing, hey? What a great kind of brand message they can have there. And that's fairly simplistic. It just works off the fact that it detects a person, they're close to the screen, will modify the digital experience as they walk by. But we have organizations already looking at how do we take that a step further. How can we look at the person, work out their age, work out their sex, look at the clothes they're wearing, so work out, put them in a wealth band, and then change the content based on that. So at 2 p.m., 40-year-old guys like Neil usually buy this product. So we'll put this product up as he goes past. And when he stops to look, we'll do some emotional detection on his face. And we'll see where he's looking. If he looks confused, we'll simplify the experience, or we'll make it bigger. If he's looking at the top left, let's bring that product down into the center. So getting very, very sophisticated about how machinery understands what's coming through that camera and then can alter the experience based on that. And that's not science fiction. That will become commonplace within the next 5 years. What I want to show you now is a joint venture that Microsoft, Morningstar, and Citibank did in the US. And it's been the most successful ever demo at Finovate. It's so successful, it was getting 850,000 unique visitors a month. And what it is really a holy grail in financial services. It's a banking website that you actually want to go to. Not only that, it gives you so much value and interest that you want to stay on there. And also, you want to actually move from an anonymous user into being a registered and hopefully a customer of Citibank based on the value this will give. And you can have a look yourself. It's called bundle.com. It's changed a bit recently, but there's still a lot of this in here. And the video probably explains it better than I can.
When it comes to money, sometimes I feel like I live in a bubble. Sure, I spend money on groceries, gas, clothes, but I have no idea if that's good or bad or even just normal. Bundle changes everything. It's the first site to show how people all over America are spending and saving. From big cities to small towns, available for free. Here's how it works. I go to bundle.com and click on everybody's money, set the filters for any category I want, age, household status, income, and location. See, here's my breakdown in Brooklyn. It's all in the bubbles. Dig a little deeper and there's spending on groceries in my zip code. Click on Get Stats and I can see not just the average spending, but the extremes, plus where my neighbors are spending. And I can compare what others are doing. My friend Julie is trying to get me to move back to Dallas. She always talks about how affordable it is, but when I click to compare cities, turns out, well, she's right. Then I can take a snapshot and post it, or share it with my friends on Facebook or Twitter. Then they can post their own comments, or do their own comparisons. Bundle makes money uncomplicated. Go to bundle.com now and see what you find.
So, fairly unique online experience that they have there. And they do this, what I particularly love about it is that thinking about how they gate their users. So people come as anonymous, you get value immediately. It plays to, you know, kind of social peer comparison and competitiveness. And you can go in and see, you know, not only where people like you shop, but you can see where the top 10% shop, whether it's food, groceries, or hardware, how much they spend in there as well. And that's the first stage. So you get the interest of the consumer very early on with no gates. Then the next gate is you sign up for that, and then you get more research and more value out of that platform. And you can do a lot more analytics. And then the third stage is if you have a Citibank credit card, it will automatically bucket your spending, and then you can compare directly automatically. So it will start building a personal financial management system for your spending, and you can compare that with people in your area or in different areas or social types across the US. And it's very interesting and very successful experiment on really how you put high levels of engagement into what is essentially a financial services scenario. And we see financial services certainly moving into that space, trying to think of ways how to be more engaging. In Singapore, OCBC Bank released, what they did is they went out and they created a new sub-brand called Frank. And the goal of Frank was to target the student market. So they opened a new, I wouldn't call it branch, I'd call it a store in Singapore, in the just by the a university there. And what they did, they went very low tech, but they put a huge amount of thought into it. So you walk outside Frank, and you think Frank, music store. Down the side of the store is all these big postcards with beautiful artwork on. There's about 100 of them. What they actually are is credit cards. And you come in, you pick the design you love, and even the price tags and the descriptions are written in pencil on bits of ripped paper to make it look, you know, like a student store. And then you go up to what certainly doesn't look like a branch teller, looks more like a point of sale in a regular retail store, and you give them the postcard and you buy the credit card. They actually sell cards. See, here we don't buy cards. The rest of the world, we don't buy them. We're lucky the bank, you know, gets to give us a credit card. They're very lucky we're customers of theirs. What they manage to do is charge different prices as well. So they have very famous artists design the cards. They also do one-off cards. So you can get a singular design. It costs about $50. Standard designs cost between 10 and 20. And what they find is the students come in and they take all these postcards. They go home. They show their friends. And then you can go online and you can pick your cards and share them on Facebook. And it's a way of showing their individualism. And they've opened three more branches based on that. And a very, very successful strategy for them. What I'm going to talk about now is avatars. Obviously, avatars are representations of us as humans in the digital landscape. And we're seeing a lot more avatars. For example, in Xbox, we have an avatar like this one. This is me. This is a slimmer version of me, a younger, better dressed version. Oh, okay. And this is me. I had to present at a conference in Sydney. Unfortunately, I couldn't make it. I was stuck in Singapore. So what I did, I presented from Singapore at home using my Xbox and Link. So Link carried my voice, and my presentation, so they had two screens here. But the Xbox took my movements and took my lip movements, my head movements, my hand movements. And so my avatar presented for over an hour, full size, down in a conference in Sydney. And people actually preferred the avatar to me, which I don't think. And there was a few of my friends from the banks there, and I did hear the odd, "Neil, your avatar's not as fat as you are," which I really appreciated, obviously. And it was an amazing experience. So the advantage of having avatars is a great way to mask, you know, the people. It's a great way to represent yourself, you know, when you've got a bad hair day, or when you're not dressed properly, or you've got lots of noisy background behind you. So an avatar will just pick up your body movements. And these are getting a lot more sophisticated as well, and a lot more detailed. For those of you who play games in the room, you're fully aware that the game models these days, with a high amount of polygon counts and shading, etc., are pretty much lifelike. If you squint your eyes, it's very difficult to tell the difference between some of the characters in the games and actually real-life objects. So as these get more sophisticated, then we can represent ourselves digitally. And it's not just for things like conferences. Once we're digital, we can interact with the digital landscape. Once we've been digitized, we can play with digital content. We can interact with presentations. We can interact in different worlds using our avatar. Also, avatars don't have to be controlled by humans. Avatars can be controlled by machinery, machine learning, by artificial intelligence systems. Microsoft has put a huge amount of research and development into this space. It's significant. You may not have seen any of it yet, but believe me, it's coming. We've patented something called the, I think it's called Guardian Angel. And what that is an avatar or robot sat in your desktop and is your helper. That means it will organize your time, your content. It will do basic tasks for you. In the future, you can see these things. I just want one that updates Facebook for me. You know, we already see robots doing Twittering. Even if it's a fairly simplistic robot, as in a lot of people just tie their Twitter feed with a piece of code to a load of RSS feeds. So they select the feeds and the keywords they want to tweet, and the code just churns through that and tweets for them. Occasionally you get some quite interesting tweets from people. So this stuff is here. If you go to weavers.com, minus the last E, you can create your own Twitter robot, and you can point it at a page on Wikipedia, and it will pretend to be that person. I went for Abraham Lincoln, and the thing was spouting political nonsense all over the place and tweeting like crazy. It was pretty amazing. But that also is a problem. So if a lot of the noise on the internet is created by robots, I'm sure you see them a lot, people trying to befriend you on Windows Live and in Facebook, and you know clearly they're not real people, then we need ways to filter that. And again, machinery can help with this. This is a video I'm probably not meant to show you from Microsoft Research, but I will anyway. And this really demonstrates, this is real, this runs, it's not in production, but it runs as you see it. And this really demonstrates what we're thinking about and how we can change the lives of people using very smart machinery.
Hi. Namaste. Bob Coswoy and hi. Thanks for coming to the triage kiosk. I'm in touch with the best doctors in the world. Are you here for your child, or yourself?
For my child.
So how can I help you?
He's been having diarrhea.
Oh no. Sorry to hear that. Hi there. What's your name?
My name is Mano.
And how old are you?
6.
So, 6 years old, right?
Almost 7.
Okay. 7 years old. Have you felt nausea?
I don't know.
I'm sorry. Have your child been vomiting at all?
No.
Okay. So let's see. Has there been a fever?
A slight.
Have you been feeling tired lately?
Yes.
Let's see. How about abdominal pains?
He's not complaining about that.
Has your tummy been hurting?
Yes.
Oh, I'm really sorry. I hope it will feel better soon. Okay. Has your child been losing weight lately?
No.
That's okay. Have you noticed whether your child's stool looks funny? Is it black or darker than usual?
It's darker than usual.
Okay. Let's see. Considering everything you told me, I'd like to schedule an appointment with the doctor, just to be sure. However, not to worry, I'm not that concerned at this point. Can you bring your child to see the doctor this Friday at 10 a.m.?
Yes.
Great. Hope you'll feel better, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye, thank you.
Come on in, have a seat.
Thank you.
Did you have a good journey?
Yes.
How's he doing now?
Yeah, slightly tired.
Is he still complaining of this?
Pretty amazing stuff, hey? We're still working on the sincerity engine. Just kind of just lack something there. A little bit. In version 2, it'll all be fixed, I'm sure. That doctor just really didn't care, did they? But that's you know, what's available. So a combination of a number of things are making that happen. The ability of the code behind the camera to make sense of the human world, the analog world, make sense of the fact that this is the mother, this is the child, they're two different people. Which one has priority? The ability for a 3D animation, essentially, then to replicate things like speech and the movement of the lips, and to be able to focus on individual, whatever. And then the huge kind of big data behind it to analyze in real time what would be the most likely cause of the child's symptoms. And then connected in to obviously the doctor's surgery to then book an appointment. So very, very interesting work from our research team on thinking about how we can improve the world through very smart machines. It doesn't get rid of the doctor experience. We all love the doctor experience. Why would we want to get rid of it? But it does certainly help get more people analyzed quicker and get them into the right place for the medical procedures they need. So what we've seen in these examples is really new ways of how humans can interact with digital assets, how humans can become digital assets, and how machinery can interact with the analog world, the world of the human, not only understand the world, i.e. the landscape and the objects, but understand our speech and almost how we think. And then how machinery can then start to become like humans, just slightly less sincere. So in the second part of this presentation, I'm going to talk through, based on feedback yesterday, the process of innovation. So hopefully this will be a good guide for you moving forward when you think about how to innovate, whether it's just yourself or whether you're a corporate innovator or working a partner or a customer. And I'll also show you how Microsoft thinks about innovation and what processes and tools that we use. And we have a product in SharePoint as well, which can help achieve this. And I'll probably step through that quite quickly as well. So how do we innovate? These are the six main areas. At the top is very focused and dedicated innovation teams. At the bottom is the broad reach and outreach programs that we operate in as well. At the top left there, we have our R&D. That's where we spend billions of dollars every year. This is where you see the products of today and tomorrow come from. We've got tens of thousands of developers in 27 business units, making sure that these products get delivered and add value to our customers and partners. The next stage, in 2 to 4 years, the labs and innovation centers. Now, what they do is they will build software for customers if they require it, end-to-end. We'll do envisioning with them there as well. But more importantly, their job is to take what comes out of research and get that into a product stream. So you may notice in Microsoft, we rarely do one-off bit plate innovations. We don't come up with a new little cool thing. What we do is we certainly research little cool things, and thousands of them at once. And we do that in research. And then the labs and innovation centers then evolve and start productizing those innovations. And then we drop them into our huge platforms. So that innovation around language translation, that will drop into Bing. You know, the innovation around gesture controls, that will drop into Xbox Kinect. So all these innovations then end up in these huge platforms that our customers and partners can then utilize in the way that they do business now. And that's how we innovate. And the Microsoft research guys are an interesting lot, to say the least. I've spent quite a bit of time with them. There's a conference, well, not quite a conference, but research open their doors once a year for a week called TechFest. And if you ever get a chance, go. It's the most amazing experience. And literally, you've got all these research guys in their little rooms, and they wheel out their projects. And you can walk around all their projects. And there's stuff with gaffer tape on and Kinect cameras and wires everywhere. And, you know, it's just an amazing experience seeing what they're innovating on. One of the most interesting things I saw recently was they had a, there was a mirror, and he looked in the mirror. I thought, great, someone's invented a mirror. His project funding's going to disappear soon. But when he switched it on, it was semi-transparent, and there was a screen behind it. So I could look at the mirror, and then it could put some digital assets and blend that with the mirror because it was behind it. So a ball appeared in my hand when I looked in the mirror, and I could juggle the ball. And then I could get a bat, and I could throw the ball and hit it with a bat, which is very, very interesting. So it's merging the kind of analog and digital world in real time. And there's lots of different scenarios for this. A retail scenario would be you have a mirror behind, for example, a fruit store. And if you've ever been in Singapore, wow, there's some fruit you don't know what it is. There really is some very strange-looking fruit. But you could pick it up and hold it up to the mirror, and above the fruit, it would say dragon fruit, origin so-and-so, packed this date. This is what its calorie content is. This is how much it costs. That enables you to loosely interact without too much technology, just using cameras and screens, between real-world objects and their digital metadata. Now, at the bottom, we have a number of cross-company innovation strategies. Probably the most famous is Think Week. Who's heard of Think Week? Okay, the least famous is Think Week. So that's probably just Microsoft people. Okay, so Think Week, I thought it was famous. Obviously, I've been in Microsoft 7 years, so I'm a bit enclosed there. But what happened for many years is everyone in the organization gets the opportunity to write a white paper. And that white paper used to be read by Bill Gates. And he'd read all the white papers for new ideas, concepts, innovation, processes, services. And then they'd select some to fund and put some time into and hopefully productize. And if you were lucky, you'd get picked up and moved from wherever you are and dropped to run that project or that innovation. That's changed slightly now. Bill's on holiday. But the Think Week still runs. And we've changed it. It's not just white papers now. You can send in videos. You can send in audio, PowerPoint, whatever media you want, into the research and development teams, and they will analyze everyone and try and work with you to evolve that product. ThinkSpace is very similar. That's more face-to-face. And we reach out to our top customers as well, the Innovation Outreach Program. So I'm not quite sure how many customers we have. Let's just say about 50 of the world's tops. We'll have the top banks. We'll have the top retails, top automotive, top resources, top public sector. And we get them together on a quarterly basis. And then we show them what we're doing in research. And then we ask for their feedback. And then we actually do joint programs with them. So a bank might go, hey, I really like what you're doing, for example, quite a few years ago with Kinect. can we start building something on that now? Or they give feedback, you know, this would be useful in my industry if you just change these things in there. So it's very industry specific, so we get the really early feedback, but we also get to engage with our customers very early on. So I want to talk about probably not so much how banks innovate. I think this applies to many, many different sectors here. And this is actually from a friend of mine, Dr. James Gardner. So I am actually stealing his content, but he's fine with that. This guy is incredibly smart. I replaced him at Microsoft, and he went off to be head of innovation at Lloyd's. And he now runs an innovation platform called spigot.com. And what he said in his incredibly detailed but very boring bank and innovation book called The Future Proof Bank was there's five different areas that you can innovate in as an organization. So you can innovate in your business model, fundamentally change how you do business, and you can partner with other people to deliver that. You can innovate in your product. You can get a new product out that's, you know, world class and better than your competitors. You can innovate in your distribution channel or your customer channel. In retail, that would be obviously your stores. In banking, it could be online, mobile, or branches. You can also innovate in the experience your customers have, whether that's digital or analog. You know, how are your customer service agents treating your customers? And there was a Metro Bank in the UK, which is the first new bank in the UK for 200 years. What they did is they went after this experience innovation. So they opened their branches 7 days a week. They opened them morning to night, so you could go in there anytime. They allowed you to take dogs into a bank branch, which you can't normally do in banks in the UK. They actually had dog water for you as well. You could go in and use free coin counters. So if you've got lots of change, you just pour them in this machine. And if you guessed how much it was, you'd win a small prize. And it's a bit like a reverse pokey machine, I suppose. You didn't have to be a customer. They just wanted you in there. You get free coffee. A lot of banks do that. They'd actually pay your parking. So if they took too long to serve you, they'd ask for your parking ticket and pay for it. So they did all these things around the experience, and they've been very, very successful. What they also did, which I particularly like, is most banks goal their sales staff and their customer staff on revenue. How many cards, how many mortgages, that kind of stuff they did in the branch. What they did is they goaled it on customer sat. So everyone's goaled on customer sat, obviously apart from the branch manager, because they still need to make some money there. But everyone else on customer sat. So it's about what the experience was like in that store for that customer. And customers love them. What they also did is they hire people based on how well they smile. I would have hired them on how well they can count money, but that's just me. And that has really paid dividends for them. They've been very disruptive. They're only operating at the moment in London, but the bank's worth at the moment, I think it's about $500 million, the UK. So they're doing very well and they're hoping to get acquired. And you can innovate in the marketplace, whether that's entering a new market, a new country, whether that's targeting a particular segment in your own market. That's another area where you can look at innovation. And the interesting thing with a laser is this chart here. So around the edge, we've got experience channels, business model, products and markets. And when we talk about innovation and innovation portfolio, we tend to think about these three levels of innovation. Incremental basically means adding next generation products and new features to products you already have. So low level innovation, but this is where most of your innovation strategy should be, because you have to, this is your bread and butter. You have to make money for the company. The next stage up is revolutionary. That means you revolutionize something that's already there, whether that's a business model, a product, a channel, experience, or a market. And then the top level is breakthrough. This is where you fundamentally change the game. It's completely new. So when we think about a portfolio of innovation, you want most incremental, you want some revolutionary, and you want one or two breakthrough. Obviously, breakthroughs tend to cost a lot more money and take a lot more time. And where I see innovation failing is where they spend too much time on breakthrough. Because they only come about once every year or couple of years, or even once every 5 years. And then when we think about what disruption levels these will deliver, so you have a look here, these gray demonstrate disruption levels. So if you have an innovation in your business model that is highly disruptive for your competitors, it will take them a long time to replicate that. That's really worrying for them. In your product space, not so much. We're all used to our competitors releasing more new products. That's business as normal. And in channel and experience, it's more disruptive. I would say if you had a really good experience here, that can be hard to replicate because you're talking about people, you're talking about processes and services. It's not just building a new product or a new technology asset. There's a lot more. You probably have to fundamentally change the culture of your organization to deliver that. And this really looks at when you get payback from innovation. So James has written a new book called Sidestep and Twist. And basically what that means is don't spend huge amounts of money researching brand new innovation. Just copy someone else's. Sidestep it, i.e. make it different enough that you can get out of the patent, and then add a new twist, which means your competitors can't copy it as well. And what he says, and rightly so, is here is the cost of invention of a new innovation. So if it's brand new, if it's breakthrough, you're spurning capital here as you go down. At the same time, you're hoping adoption will get to a trigger point here, which means you'll get the payback and then you have to get all the way up here before you've even broke even. So inventions that have failed on this, I think the Segway is one that can be mentioned. The Segway costs a huge amount of money to invent. Has it been commercially successful? No. Maybe it's a great invention, but do you see Segways driving around here? No. I've never been on one. They look great, we all love them, but it hasn't been commercially successful. And so a lot of the best inventions are ones which start here because they've copied or re-represented, let's say, a current concept. And so the payback starts hitting here and hence is more financially viable. So how can you create a culture of innovation inside your organization? The first thing really is just creating that awareness that we're doing something different. This is not business as normal. We are out to do stuff which is different and creating that brand inside your organization. Having the tools and processes for collection of ideation, ideas and concepts, and then going through the evaluation stage. I'm sure we all work in organizations where we've got loads of great ideas, but nothing ever happens. It's because we don't have the process. We don't know how to evaluate them. And then if we don't know how to evaluate them, we can't work out their commercial success. If we can't work out their commercial success, no one's going to fund it, and it's never going to be delivered. And it's about showing thought leadership. So being the thought leaders on the future of your industry, being the thought leader on the future of technology, if it's a technology asset. And also recognizing people who have come up with ideas. So if you get people putting ideas and generating great concepts for you, how do you recognize them inside your organization? How can you turn those people into rainmakers so they keep giving you great ideas and they keep spreading the brand of your innovation culture? But most importantly, how does it correlate to success? So we can invent stuff as much as we want. We can evaluate them. We can get them out as products. If someone says, how much money did that make you? How did it reduce cost? How did it change customer perception? And you can't answer that, your innovation team's in trouble. And innovation teams tend to last about 18 months. If at that point they haven't delivered value, they tend to lose their funding. So having success and the measurement for success at the very start when you're thinking about the evaluation is critical. A bit like test-driven development. You put the tests in at the beginning. So you make sure the software is going to be robust and scalable. The same with innovation, putting the measures at the beginning. And here's 10 rules of innovation from the littleinnovationbook.com, which is another of James's work. Thank you, James. And I just think this is great. This is really just innovation on one page. These are the things you need to think about. You go to littleinnovationbook.com, you can't go wrong. And I'll step through these about creating a strategy, defining what innovation means, etc. So let's just jump straight into it. So create an innovation strategy. There's three types of innovation strategies. My favorite, do nothing. Brilliant. No risk, no cost, no heads. Excellent. And you see this in companies that are either, you know, at the very top of their game, or companies who have just one product, so they just keep delivering that product out. Safest innovation strategy of all. You can call yourself head of innovation for a company that does nothing, and then you can do nothing. Brilliant. You can play not to lose, which is where most people play. They want to stay the number three retailer in New Zealand. They don't want to be number four, but we want to stay number three. But we don't want to be number two. That will cost too much, too risky, too hard. Or you can play to win. That tends to be where the innovation teams, the best innovation teams are the ones that report to the CEO. The slightly less successful innovation teams report somewhere down in IT. If you're playing to win, your innovation team should be in the business. It should be under the CMO, should be under the CEO, or even the CFO, and should be very well funded, because you want to leapfrog. I don't want to be the number three retailer in New Zealand. I want to be number two or number one. And we're going to put a lot of money into this, and we're going to make this successful. And also define what innovation means. We hear the word a lot, innovation, innovation. I've released this great product, it's innovation. The next version of the washing powder is innovation, now with extra bubbles. We changed the font type on the screen, it's innovation. But be very clear what it is inside your organization. Here's a few things I think of. It's not business as normal. If it is business as normal, they'll take your funding and put it in the product team. It's doing something different that is successful. You have an innovation team because you don't want to do business as normal. You need to do something different because whatever you're doing is not working, or it's just keeping you at the same market position. Or you can go out and disrupt your competitors. You see lots of this. You see innovation which is delivered, and you know it has no financial value. It's not reducing cost. It's hardly touching customer sat. So why do they do it? Why are they pumping millions of dollars into this to scare their competitors? To throw the gauntlet down there, to get the competitors worried about what you're going to do next with your product, market, channel, or business model strategy. And make sure the role of the innovator is clear. Is it to be an ideator? Do you create ideas? Do you invent stuff? Is it you that does that? Or are you going to be the executors? Are you going to be the guys who manage that and deliver the product or service? Are you evangelists? Are you the ones going out and preaching about how great, you know, the future of technology or the industry is? Are you developers? Are you building prototypes and proofs of concepts? Or do you manage the whole process from end to end? Well, really, you're all of these as innovators. You have to do all of them well to be able to succeed. But defining, you know, the brand and the working methodology and the KPIs of the innovation team has to be done up front. But always have a connection to the money. How will this drive revenue, reduce cost, or have greater customer sat? It has to be aligned to the business strategy. Otherwise, these innovations will have no use and your funding will disappear. And there's three big myths in innovation. It's about great ideas, great concepts. It's doing, you know, the next big thing. We've got an innovation team and, wow, we're going to put banks on the moon. You know. Actually, I'll write that one down. I'll speak to Virgin Money about that. They got a little. Innovation is risky and unpredictable. That is absolutely not true. With a great innovation process, you can manage the evolution of ideas through to delivery. With thinking about tying it to the money, you can have a stake in the ground about how much revenue it will make you and what the impact is. With proper testing cycles, you can understand the impact on your customer base. It doesn't have to be risky and unpredictable. But they will say, where's my breakthrough? So setting these kind of messages up front about the innovation team will stop this happening. Because you've got 18 months. So after 12 months, there'll be people like this. Okay, where's my breakthrough? If they weren't educated up front on how you're going to deliver your innovation portfolio. That is a scary looking woman. I spend quite a lot of time trying to help companies manage the technologists, securities, and also the CMO office. So what we do is, you know, I spend the time, imagine with the, say, the head of retail banking. And we come up with this great concept. It's beautiful. It's elegant. It's, you know, it's going to be highly disruptive. It's this shining star of innovation up here. It's bright. You can hardly look at it. And we're all really excited. It's, yeah, I'll fund it. Right, let's go, Microsoft. They don't usually talk like that, but still. And then what happens is it gets pushed over to security. And they go, no way. Not on a phone, not outside our file. No, what we'll have to do is we'll just have to cut this in half because it doesn't match our security model. It's too risky. And then the innovation starts dimming. And then you go to technology, and they're like, oh, well, no, that doesn't fit our blueprint. No, no, oh, no, no, we'll roll out that technology in 5 years' time. Can you wait till then? No. And then you go to the CMO office, and they say, we could do, but, you know, it doesn't fit our brand. But if you put this big sticker on it, it'll be fine. So we start with a big shining star of innovation, and we end up with a little dark dirt ball of regular product. And so a lot of my job is to try and manage that as it goes across those gates and work with security and go, no, wait a minute, what if I turn it on the side? And then we do something, wait a minute, we can kind of get that to fit. And it drops a bit. And then technology the same, marketing the same. And then we end up with a slightly glowing, nice ball of innovation. So it's always best to shoot there and end up about there. But too many times we shoot there and then it just disappears. And the important thing is to answer these three key questions. Can we do this? Is it feasible? Is it technologically feasible? Do we have enough money? Do we have the staff? If not, just pull it in your portfolio. Save that one for later until technology catches up or you have more money or staff. Should we do this? Is it something that the market will accept? Is it something that our CMO office, will it fit our brand? And also when? And these three questions should be used to evaluate every single idea immediately. If you can't answer these three, then it's not going to get funded. Drown the puppy. Not my phrase. I love dogs myself, personally. Cats, not so much. Dogs, love them. It is an industry term, so please don't tweet I said this. But it's basically fail fast, fail early. And it's called drowning the puppy because we get really attached to our ideas. Especially if we invented them ourselves. Oh, this is beautiful. You take it to someone else, they're like, oh, my God, what is that? You know, nobody likes to hear the baby's ugly. But we'll keep trotting it around the company, trying to sell it and get funding. Don't bother. Get rid of it. Move on. Learn. Fail fast. Learn off that experience. It's even worse when it's like the CEO's come up with the idea. That is, they're like, oh, beautiful baby there. I really like that. Has that puppy got water wings? I think so. But there's ways to do that. We'll talk about crowd and how the crowd can tell the CEO that his idea is rubbish anonymously, which is great. Share everything. You know, spend time with partners, with other people across your teams. The best, very best ideas I've seen are collisions of different ideas. Things collide and then you get something new and interesting. And you can only do that if you start sharing with it, because you're also focused on the innovation team. Just have one trajectory. Let other trajectories collide on that idea and see what happens. And manage the people. Think about the structure of your team. Who's the ideator? Who's the evangelist? Who are the developers? And think about the different people. Not all innovation is done by, you know, Gen Ys. You know, a lot of it's done by baby boomers, Gen X. But also, it's the collision of ideas again, which is going to bring you the best innovation. Not all customers are Gen Y. Probably the ones who buy your products are Gen X and baby boomers. Now, I'm going to finish off with crowdsourcing. So here's some stats on the best sources of ideas. And the best ones, the most significant, are from employees and then business partners. Unfortunately, consultants are way down here, and internal R&D teams are right near the bottom. And where do the opportunities come from? Are internal. So how do we get them? We need a platform. And what I'd like to show you first is the power of crowds and how this can be viral. And then we'll look at deconstructing this video. I'm sure we've all been at festivals like that. Some lone, very strange guy dancing like that, usually me. But what can we learn from this? Is expose the unexpected. If you see things seem a little odd, it's not business as normal, it's very different. It's going against the flow. Investigate that. Why is it doing that? Should that be promoted? Can we use that as best practice? And how do you get people to share that practice? Secondly, we need to create a tipping point, which, as we saw, we had the lone dancer at the beginning. We suddenly got enough people that we had behind it, and this is where you start to create the brand around the innovation, where funding starts to appear. And then it starts to become less risky, just less odd, frankly, in the dancing case. And then, finally, we all get shared joy. That means everyone's behind it. It's been a huge success. We've got massive funding. We're going to release version 2.0 of this product or service. So the power of the crowd is significant. We do have a software platform to manage this. And it's based on SharePoint 2010. It uses social computing, uses project server for managing your innovation portfolio, and allows you to execute in the software space. It's fully customizable, and you know, MCS, all these partners here, can implement it. And it's a free download for SharePoint. SharePoint isn't free, by the way, but the download is. It's called the IPM. You can search for it. So when we think about innovation, think about the four E's. Engage. You can set challenges. So a challenge might be, you put a challenge up that sort of focus innovation. So I want to sell more credit cards. And then people pull up ideas on that. Other people rate them and discuss them and, you know, collaborate around that idea. Then we start evolving that idea, building it out. Then we evaluate it. So can we, should we, and when? Does it fit our business? And how much will it cost? And then we move into execution, which is business as normal. We're building software, essentially, or we're changing processes inside our organization. And this platform manages all of those. This collection of Smarties on screen is to represent an innovation funnel. So we get lots of great ideas in here, and we capture them in the tool. We formulate, evaluate, define, and outcomes and products at the end. Here is a screenshot, so you can go in and see the challenges that are available. And then the biggest thing is encouraging people to get on there. But they get recognition. You know, it displays who come up with the idea, what people have rated it. It gives you a message, lists all the ideas, who's voted on it and how many people. In here, the ability to create new ideas on the fly. So it's a full collaboration platform for innovation. And the best ideas come to the top. So when the CEO's great idea, you know, suddenly flops because no one's voted on it, then nobody has to worry about how you're going to tell him that. He knows. He just looks and he's got a grumpy face for a week. But hey, can't please everyone. But this is what that platform delivers. There's the rating and the voting, and it gives you trending on popularity. What they did at Lloyd's was they gave virtual dollars to everyone in Lloyd's, and they got to put those virtual dollars on the ideas. And the best ideas came to the top, and they made a little stock market game out of it. And then they could cash in those dollars and use that in development to build prototypes or proof of concepts. The dollars actually had a value to that. And here's the reporting. So this gives you your portfolio spread on idea types by rating and by group ownership. So it gives you deep insight built obviously on SQL Server and Excel services there. So what should we do tomorrow? Just think beyond your current environment. Just start thinking outside the box. How can we do something differently? How can we change the culture inside an organization? Look at some of these big mega trends in your industry or in technology. How will they impact your business? What strategy do you have around that? What will those trends be in 5 years' time? How will they collide, the technology trends, with our industry, our products, our business? And explore what your organization will need from a strategy and how it could be very successful and worthwhile for your business. And that's me. Thank you.